Hello, this is Texas Education Commissioner Michael Williams, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Texas Tribune Tribcast, a weekly educational production I am proud to rate as commended, if not exemplary. So sit back, relax, and listen carefully, because there will be an end of podcast exam. And now here's your host, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you, Commissioner. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the first week of October. Joining me is executive editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Reporter Morgan Smith.
Hello.
And reporter Jay Root.
Hello.
Thank you all for coming. I hope that this will be tamer and more civil than the U.S. Senate debate last night between Paul Sadler and Ted Cruz.
Just answer the question, Reeve.
Well, I'm sorry you think I'm a troll,
Jay. We should all talk at the same
time. I don't think you're a troll.
You know, I would compromise with Martians was a takeaway line. What was that? I'll work with Martians if they have the right idea. That was a Ted Cruz line.
That was what Brad Watson, the moderator, said afterwards. If anyone has a good idea about how to control this debate, even the Martians, I'll
You know, it was an
with.
Interesting debate. It was, you know, it was like, it's that old political question about having a beer with one of these guys. Nobody wanted to have a beer with one of those guys after that thing.
I think they sort of tested the limits, too, of you know, Smash Mouth. I mean, certainly Sadler did. You know, calling him a troll. Just really pushing.
Call him a liar straight out.
Call him a liar. I mean, it was real. I mean, obviously, he had to make a splash because he's, you know, nobody knows who he is. He's far down in the polls. But I'm not sure that that's the right way to get attention. I don't know. I mean, maybe it will be. We'll see.
It looked like a schoolyard fight to me, and it looked like at some point in that thing, both of them stopped talking to the audience. You know, to stop talking to the voters.
And if you're Sadler and you're thinking, I mean, what is the benefit of coming across just so aggressively and kind of just in your face? I mean, what is kind of the motivation
behind that? You've got to make news. I mean, he has to make news. If he wants anyone to know his name or that he's running for Senate, he has to take advantage of this opportunity by creating some conflict that's going to get on the airwaves all around the state, not just on this WFAA.
They turned Belo debate and Texas Senate into nationally trending hashtags for a while there. It looked like the Twitter feed was just a bunch of flashing lights. It was amazing.
All the partisans
were, you know, doing what the candidates were doing on screen.
They were just so up in each other's faces. And, you know, I mean, at one point I was just thinking, wow, Sadler's just going to jump out and just attack the guy physically. I mean, it really got hot. Look, sometimes in political contests we see a contact sport. But this really, to me, was one of the hottest or most heated debates I've ever seen. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. They were. I really do think they forgot about the audience. They were sitting across the table. Part of it was format. They're sitting across the table from each other. They're looking at each other. They're within, you know, they're in each other's personal space, and they're calling each other names and interrupting each other. And, you know, two people trained to be aggressive courtroom lawyers, sort of at the height of their game, being aggressive courtroom lawyers. It was like dragging a bag of meatballs through a kennel. It was unbelievable.
And you like this format.
I do like this format. I think, you know, you gotta rely on the candidates at some level to control themselves and to sort of follow sort of some basic rules of propriety, which I don't think either one of them did. And, you know, they stopped having a conversation and started having a barking contest. I felt sorry for Brad Watson, the moderator. You know, some people thought that he didn't control it well enough. I'm not sure you could have got a leash on that thing.
What do you do as a moderator in that situation?
Fire hose.
I sort of thought the opposite. I thought he jumped in. He was a little bit eager to jump in, I thought. I think if you have that debate where you make a big deal of, like, we're going to throw out the rules and it's going to be like mano a mano at this table, then you just got to let them run a little bit more. He was pretty quick to be like, you guys are interrupting each other, which just adds the confusion and creates this atmosphere of interruption. Instead of just, you know, if they're going to throw questions at each other, let them throw questions at each other if you don't have any rules.
I thought he had to, really, because, and I think he waited, you know, for a while, and then honestly, I just saw Sadler was so, I mean, he was basically like, answer the question, yes or no, answer the question. And he really wouldn't let Cruz finish. And then Cruz turned that back on him later and said, okay, well, now I can do the same thing you did. And it really felt like a cross-examination. They obviously are both lawyers. That was clear. I thought the other thing that was really striking, very striking for you know, a reporter who's covered Democrats trying to run statewide. For years, we've seen Democrats, it started, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, Democrats really trying to get distance between themselves and the National Party and running away from the president. We saw Bill White, you know, was busy when Obama came to town.
That's Thursday?
Yeah.
Shoot.
Right. And he stayed away from
and
Obama.
And yet he went and did The View and Letterman.
Right. But anyway, Sadler completely embraced Barack Obama. I've never seen that. I mean, I know that there are other people around who can remember when nominees probably embrace, say, Lyndon Johnson. But when's the last time a Democrat in Texas embraced the sitting president, somebody who was running for a high state office? I don't remember it.
And won. I mean, they've done it and lost a bunch, but
right.
do it and win is something different altogether.
But I mean, they just seem to like, hey, I'm running my own race. That's his deal. That's my. But he really personalized it and said, you've slandered the president.
Right.
And you know the words that were thrown around, crazy. You know, you're a liar. I mean, well, that was some tough rhetoric coming out of that debate.
Well, the other thing that was sort of interesting to watch, and just sort of stand back from it, was they both figured out very quickly, or maybe before the debate, where the other guy's buttons were, and they were jamming each other's buttons. You could tell that, you know, like you say, they both looked like they were going to come out of their seat at some point.
And I thought Sadler, it was very clear that Sadler holds Cruz in a particularly high disdain.
Minimum high.
Yeah, I mean, really, really, you sense there was a strong dislike there.
Well, he called him a troll.
Right. I mean, yeah, exactly. And I sensed that Cruz sort of tried to do this 30,000 feet thing and like, you know, I'm just going to sort of ignore you and go to my talking points. But when Sadler talked about Cruz's wife, that was when you felt bored. Boy, he just pushed a button.
What did he say about his wife?
It was, you know, about her that they disagreed on some border security. It's all about this board that she sits on. But anyway, he said, you know, I haven't made your wife or your family an issue. Don't make my family an issue, and something like that. And I felt like that Cruz went into the debate probably thinking, yeah, you know, this guy Sadler, whatever. But I think I'm guessing he left it thinking, man, I really don't like that guy either.
So the walk-in on this was, you know, Cruz didn't have to do anything. Cruz, you know, no news is good news for Cruz on this thing. Sadler had to make some news. Sadler had to make, you know, hey, look at me, pay some attention to me, I'm a viable alternative, come to my side. And I think he had the heat to do that. I don't think he did it.
He definitely made news, but is it the kind of news that's going to help him at all?
I don't know that he made news. I mean, if you watch the debate, it was sort of fun to watch, and it was, you know, it was like a really great episode of the, you know, Housewives of whichever state you're in. But other than that, I don't know that it brought anybody
to... He didn't make substantive news.
He didn't, you know, what was in that debate that made you change your mind or made you open your mind or made you come to Sadler if you were undecided? I didn't see it. And he's got one more debate. Cruz is doing to him what Dewhurst did to Cruz. You know, I'm not going to debate you. I'm going to do a little bit of a Rose Garden thing here. And all Cruz has to do is stay alive for an hour and walk out. What Sadler has to do is try to start on television with an audience there, what he hasn't been able to do in any other forum so far.
Have we seen any difference in the rhetoric that's coming from Cruz in terms of it, in comparison to the primary, now that he's running in a general election? Has he kind of come back more around to the middle? I don't know if that's something that would have come out in the debate, but I'm thinking particularly of Cruz's sit down with Evan and Julian Castro, where it was sounding a bit more like a different candidate than the one that was in the primary. And an example of that would be Cruz said that he thought the San Antonio's sales tax increase to support pre-K was a good idea. And that is something that the Tea Party in San Antonio is going against. And so I don't know if that's anything that came out in the debate or if it's something that Sadler could kind of try and press a little bit more out of Cruz in this next go around.
I think he is coming toward the middle. I don't know that it benefits Sadler in any way. I mean, you know, I think he's coming to the middle in a way that brings
maybe
him more in line with some of the Dewhurst Republicans. You know, hey, I know you voted for Dewhurst, but come to me. I'm not an unreasonable guy.
Are there particular issues where it's clear that he's gone more towards the middle?
Well, I think what Morgan just pointed out, anything that gives Grover Norquist the hiccups is going to be something different from what Cruz was doing in the primaries. I can work with anybody. I'll cross the aisle. He certainly wasn't doing that during the primary. You know, I think he does sound – he still sounds very conservative. He doesn't sound moderate, but he sounds more moderate than he did.
I think it's more like a stylistic change. It's just he's sort of taken on the air a little bit of, you know, look, I'm probably going to get elected here. Right. And just like you said with, you know, not only doing two debates, I mean, you know, he's in a different position now. I mean, he doesn't want to go out there. And he said it last night, I'm not going to go give my opponent free airtime. I mean, that right. kind of does sound like something Dewhurst might have said when he was riding high. It's what people say when they're riding high. It's what you do when you're riding high. And right. let's face it, he is riding very, very high.
I was wondering how you were going to end
okay.
that.
Very high. Well, I mean, it's what was 50? The Lyceum poll was 50 to 24?
Right. Right.
That's just unbelievable. It's like 25 points down. I mean, you're...
It's a 2-1. It's, you know...
You're just...
That's a 60-30 race. That's
done. Cooked.
That wasn't the most shocking Lyceum poll results of all time, though, to see that the Republicans have a stronghold in Texas.
No, but that's a heck of a margin. I mean, you know,
it
the
really
regular
is.
Margin, the regular, you know, sort of nameless Texas Democrat will get 43-42% almost every time since 1996. And in fact, this poll has Romney at 58 and Obama at 39. When you close up the undecideds, that's going to put, if that holds, that puts Obama in that range. That's about where you would expect Texas to be. But the race right behind that is 50 to 24. You know, it's just unbelievable. It's a 2-1. I mean, it's a hugely Republican state, and that's clear in the presidential numbers, but Sadler clearly hadn't gotten any traction and hasn't even achieved the traction a nameless Democrat would achieve.
There's an amount of undecided voters in that race, too.
Yeah,
that
26.
Was about 26. How does that compare to...
They were just waiting for the first
debate. If you close that up, if you just split that the same way, it would be a 66-33 race. You know, 33 is not 43. You know, he's performing...
He's on track to perform below...
10 nobody. Points below normal.
People, yeah. Right. That's...
But this was before the debate, maybe...
He's riding low.
there's another debate ahead, you know, and the numbers in a race where, you know, both of these guys are less well known than everybody else on the ballot will kind of descend toward the normal numbers. So, you know, Sadler will start to approach the 43. It doesn't look like he's going to get there, though, if these numbers don't change. And you know, Cruz will end up, you know, somewhere in the high 50s, low 60s.
Basically, the polls have shown that Romney's doing better than McCain did. So we don't know what it'll maybe tighten up. I mean, obviously it could, and there's still plenty of time for it to tighten up. But this looks like a pretty good Republican year so far in Texas. I mean,
yeah,
which it always is. You know, where's the news there? But I mean, everybody keeps saying, well, you know, little by little, Democrats make little incremental changes and a little bit better. It's like, well, I don't see that.
Yeah, the news there is if you're in a marginal race or in a marginal district, you know, the Canseco Gallego race, the Wendy
right,
Davis,
exactly.
Mark Shelton race. If you're looking at national polls and stuff, and you're a Democrat, you're saying, well, Mitt Romney's not doing so well. Maybe he won't carry my opponent across the line. But then you look at these Texas numbers and you go, oh, yeah, it's Texas.
Yeah.
So, you know, the coattails may operate completely differently here than they do in, you know, Missouri or Massachusetts or one of those states that's kind of in play.
You mentioned that we're taping this before the first presidential debate.
Right.
Any expectations looking into that? Do you expect it to be similar or dissimilar from the U.S. Senate debate we had last night?
Well, if we could get a troll comment,
you know,
tonight,
I've never heard a presidential candidate call another one a liar outside of a primary. You know that, they're going to be very, very measured. You know, the Fight Club in the press has been really active for the last 2 weeks. Oh, this is very consequential. It's going to be terrific, and you know, the whole race hinges on this. It's an important debate, and you know they're both going to be very, very cautious and hope that they score, but very cautious that they don't let the other guy score. So you know, I think a lot of people that ditched civics in high school are going to look at the first half hour of this and go, yeah, that's why I left in high school and switch over to the baseball game or something.
I mean, you got to think Romney will be attacking, right? I mean, he needs to.
He will be the Sadler in this situation.
I would assume so.
I think on some level he's going to attack. On some level, he's going to point out Obama's problems and remind people why they might be voting against Obama and show himself to be a viable alternative. A lot of people, you know, are just looking. You know, a lot of the people that don't like Obama might have been more comfortable with a, you know, a Gingrich or a Perry or a, you know, Santorum or whoever, and maybe haven't come around to Romney yet. He's kind of, you know, left some of them a little cold. He needs to close that.
Anything in the, going back to the Lyceum poll, that indicates what how Texans are thinking as they go into this debate?
They had a couple of weird numbers in the Lyceum poll. They showed a lot of areas in education, for example, where people in Texas, these same people who are showing, you know, the strong Republican trend, would support tax increases for this or that or the other thing. One of the highest thing that they would say in education that they said they would support higher taxes for was teacher pay raises. That doesn't sound like a bunch of Republicans. They had a deal in here where Texans were split, 42% and 43% for and against whether a college education is worth the money that it costs, whether that return on investment is worthwhile. They're still against federal health care really strongly if they're Republicans, and for federal health care really strongly if they're Democrats. So that, you know, as clean a partisan divide as there is in the poll. And then there was one other thing where they were asked how they felt about, you know, various institutions and people. And the highest rated institution of the things on the list was the Environmental Protection Agency.
Wow.
Which, you know, just sounds really weird. The bottom three were the Tea Party, Wall Street, and the Occupy movement. So, you know, that list, if you just go through it, from most popular to least, were EPA, Romney, Perry, immigrants, Obama, banks, unions, Paul Ryan, Joe Biden. You're below banks and unions. The Tea Party, Wall Street, and the Occupy.
He's buried under banks and unions.
That's
there.
Right. That, you know, that's what happens to you. So there was a bunch of interesting
very
stuff.
Very pro the man.
Right.
Right. Here in Texas.
Right. How that translates, I don't know. You know, the candidates have been saying, Texas candidates have been saying for the last probably 6 or 8 weeks, you guys may have heard it before that, that education was a rising issue in their primaries. You know, people had been in 2010 certainly talking about economy, jobs, immigration, stuff like that. Now they're talking about schools, school cuts, teachers, all of that kind of stuff. And that's starting to show up under most important problems in polls like this one.
It's interesting that to me that the largest budget or education cuts were enacted last session, and there just hasn't been much blowback on that, as far as I can tell. Am I wrong about that? I'd be interested to hear what you have to say, Morgan.
I think a lot of people were talking about it, education cuts coming up as an issue in the primaries, and you had some Republican candidates talking about it in the primaries. You know, when you talking about education and kind of having these pro-education platforms, when you just would not have heard that in 2010. But I think when you look at how the outcomes of the races, you can't really point to any of the races, even though there were several where the candidate that was more aligned with education issues won. You couldn't really point to education as being the issue that turned the race in that candidate's favor. So I think while it's something that people are talking about and it's definitely a part of the conversation, it's not a deciding factor.
It's such a mushy issue. If you just say education, it's such, you know, you could be talking about teachers or pay raises, and I could be talking about testing, and that one could be talking about bond issues, you know.
That one.
I know, but just the quality of public education, and the fact that, I mean, you know, everybody saw that there were theater teachers or music teachers that lost their jobs. Some right. counselors lost their jobs. A lot of teachers were complaining that their workload had gone up. I mean, I think
that has happened, but the situation has been very different from district to district. You haven't seen statewide, you know, all of the, you know, every single district has lost its fine arts teachers or things like that. And I also think that the way that districts have tried to make the cuts is to cut everything except for teachers, except for kind of the things that really affect the core instructional quality of the schools. And so I think that's something that also might affect, you know, the public's perception of what exactly has happened. I think there's strain that's happening at the school district level, but it's not something that's uniform across the state, and it's also not something that might be readily apparent to voters.
And the people that said that they wanted to cut education, that there was a lot of waste in education, that sort of proves their case in some ways, that there were some cuts to make here that voters and that parents and that educators wouldn't. There's some cuts you could make that, you know, might be tough for a minute, but you're not going to miss the money. And if you're not going to miss the money, why are we spending the money? I mean, they're sort of looking at that as proof. In a political sense, none of this is reduced to a question that you could sort of get into a mailer.
Right.
It's not like this or that.
I think they were successful at it, really. Right. I mean, the people who pushed this were successful at it. I also thought it was noteworthy that they're...
I guess I'm not ready to say that I think they were successful at it. I think that, yes, they will be able to... I mean, I don't know. How are they writing? What's that?
Are they writing high or low?
I think they're writing medium.
Well, I mean, the body politic seems to have absorbed the hiring of Michael Williams at the TEA, and he got a $30,000 pay raise, and that seems to have gone off without any kind of criticism. I was surprised that the Democrats didn't go, you know, lose their minds over that, but everybody seems to be okay with that.
That was for doing the intro to this podcast that he got that.
Well, he has a wonderful voice, doesn't he? He's got a great, movie voice or radio voice or whatever.
Yeah, why has the reaction to that been muted?
You know, I'm not sure. I asked some Democrats about that who had kind of been making a fuss about other issues in education, and the response I got was, "Well, we kind of have to pick and choose what we try and make a big deal out of, and we think that might be a little bit too much like inside baseball for people to understand that, you know, this person who was appointed to the education agency got a raise, and
that's not inside baseball at all.
Yeah, I didn't.
Perry appoints someone, gives them a huge raise. Right.
I mean, off
the bat.
It wasn't.
It's pretty simple.
Yeah, and I also think that a lot of the same people were complaining about the former education commissioner Robert Scott, and now they're kind of confused because from their perspective, Robert Scott is actually probably the better option, and so it's kind of. Yeah, it wasn't an answer that I necessarily bought as being a good reason for their not making a bigger fuss about it, because it does seem pretty clear cut.
For some reason, these don't blow up. You know, when Phil Wilson got hired to run TxDOT, former Perry chief of staff, Perry brought him back. He went off to the utility industry, came back to the state. He's running Texas Department of Transportation and got a huge raise. And that was a story and kind of went away. I mean, sometimes...
The death of outrage.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, sometimes that's just not what people are worked up about.
That's going to be the title of Jay's next book.
The death of outrage.
Yeah. Meanwhile, an issue that is apparently a little bit more clear-cut that Perry thinks he can really sell is this sort of discomfort with higher education. As you see in the poll, 42% of the people in the poll say they don't think higher education is worth it, and Perry's basically on sort of a tour... talking about affordability, more talking about forward planning for higher education than anything
else. So he wants them to give you a price tag at the beginning for the whole 4 years?
His platform is so there's the tuition freeze idea, which we talked about a little bit on the last week's podcast, where you pay the same amount for 4 years, and then on your fifth year of college, it might go up or would go up. And then he's also calling for when you are starting school, say I'm going to UT, UT has to tell me up front how much 4 years will cost, how much 5 years will cost, how much 6 years will cost, with the idea that that will incentivize me to get out in 4 years because that will obviously be cheaper. He also is going to push outcomes-based funding, where right now Texas universities get money based on how many students they enroll, and he wants them to get 10% based on how many students they graduate. So it sort of incentivizes the institutions to get students out as well. And actually, it was interesting. So they've been doing this 10% thing for a few years now, trying to get that through, and it's gotten slowly built momentum. And now Dan Branch, the chairman of the House Higher Education Committee, I was talking to him the other day. He said, you know, 10% was good 2 years ago, but I'd like to see us go to 25% of their funding based on outcomes, which might make some universities nervous just because it's a change.
What's the argument against that?
Yeah, what is the resistance to it?
There's some concerns about how predictable it would be, you know, how much their funding would fluctuate. Also, right now, they are budgets are tight, and they're not sure they should be messing with the formulas when budgets are tight. You know, other states, it seems to be a national trend. Tennessee has gone to 100% outcomes-based. It's just not the way it's been done. Oh, you know, these institutions are famous for not wanting to change too rapidly.
Isn't the time when your budget's tight the time to mess with the formulas? Isn't that how that works?
Well, you see people making that argument.
Right.
But, you know, it's, and the way to do the formula has been tough. You know, initially they were looking at graduation rates, and they were looking at other things. And some of the formulas they put out with that outcomes-based funding had some of the top graduate-producing schools like UT and A&M losing money. And so they need to find something that is predictable and has results that seem logical to everyone to have enough buy-in. Because you can't come, you know, if you have the most powerful universities losing money on this on a new system, they have powerful friends who will try it as hard as they can to stop it.
Do they have any provision here? I know that, you know, some of the schools in the UT system, UTEP, for example, maybe UT Pan Am, have made the argument that our students are, a lot of our students are working students, and they're not on a four-year plan, they're on a six-year plan.
Yeah, and Natalicio, the President Natalicio of UTEP, has made this case for a lot of these proposals. So you see, there are two schools that sort of have become sort of the examples of the four-year tuition freeze. UT Dallas, who requires it for all their students, and UT El Paso, who has it as an option for their students. At UT Dallas, it's been pretty popular, but it's also clearly not a way to save money. It's just a way to plan better because UT Dallas has the highest tuition in the state.
Right.
I was struck by a couple of things. One was that this proposal is sort of flowing in some ways from deregulating tuition, right? I mean, from the fact that that's why we're talking about it now, because it's really gotten high for a lot of people, I guess. And the second thing is that this isn't sort of the typical, or hasn't been what we've heard lately. Lately, it's all been, you know, slamming the federal government. This is like, look, saying that we've got a problem in Texas. People are getting priced out of higher education, and we need to do something about it. I thought that I was struck by that.
Well, and going back to UTEP has an option for a guaranteed tuition, and it's not popular because their students, they're sort of going to school off and on. They're working,
right.
And they just don't want to commit to 4 years and have a big jump in the fifth year. They'd rather just sort of pay as they go and trust that tuition won't go up too high. And as for regulation, it is sort of about that. You know, it's not like tuition did not increase every year when it was regulated by the legislature.
It did it in steps that were kind of set, and they were relatively small.
Percentage-wise, they weren't dramatically different. Yeah.
Didn't it skyrocket, though?
It went up significantly that first year afterwards, but since then, the pace has not been dramatically different from what it was when it was regulated.
Okay.
It's just a matter of whose responsibility it is now. Now it's not the legislator's responsibility for the tuition. It's the institution's responsibility.
Well, and the raw numbers have gotten huge. I've got a junior in high school. Jay has a high schooler. I mean, when you start looking at the price tags on these things, it's, holy cow. It really, really is expensive.
Yeah, I sat down with a financial advisor. He kind of had to hold my hand there for a little while
because it
is a big check.
But the proposals that Perry is touting are not, none of them are necessarily cost savers. They are all sort of personal responsibility and institutional responsibility to get as many students graduating as possible. Because it's sort of, given that our tuition is where it is, given that it's not going to go down probably, we want you to get out as fast as possible because that's good for the workforce in the state. It's good for you because it's the best way to save money. But it's not really about bringing tuition down. He's proposing $10,000 degrees, obviously, which is a lower-cost alternative. He wants schools to create lower-cost alternatives, but it's not really about changing necessarily.
Is there any concern that outcomes-based funding, I mean, how does that affect the quality of the education that students are receiving?
Yeah, there's some concern that it will just, schools will be like, well, we need to graduate more students, let's just pass them through, you know? I mean, no school would ever admit to doing that. But, you know, there's some concern about that. But, you know, like Bill Powers at UT has made getting four-year graduations up one of his top priorities. It's a growing discussion of just, you know, why aren't students getting out of college?
You know, when that $10,000 degree thing came out, there were a lot of snickers and people were saying this is ridiculous. But there now, I mean, there's going to be a $10,000 degree, right? I mean, is that...
Well,
there are
nine that have been announced or implemented in the state. But, you know... Yes, but what is it exactly?
Well, that's what I wonder. Like, can I get one of those for one of my kids? I mean, would I want that? Is it something that average people would want for their kids, and they can put on their resume and actually have a college degree just like anybody else? I mean, that's a lot cheaper. It's like $10,000 versus say $100,000. It's a pretty big difference.
I mean, it depends on where you go, right? So, like the average net price, like what students on average pay out of pocket to go to UT El Paso, for example, which is actually the cheapest, so it's maybe not the best example, but once you take the average scholarships and grants and stuff, the average student is only paying a little over $2,000 a year. I mean, you know, there's ways to lower the cost of your degree, but right now they're $10,000 degree. The models are all different. None of them are going to be the traditional college experience. So if you want your kid to have that, then they're not going to be able to get a $10,000 degree without grants and scholarships. There's one at UT Permian Basin that is a four-year sort of, you come on campus, but it's essentially a merit scholarship.
But don't you, I mean, when you walk out of there, when you walk into an employer and you've got one of those $10,000 degrees on your resume, does it look any different
to
the employer?
Yeah, that's what I wonder. Does it look like
that's the idea. I mean, you know, which is sort of exactly what Perry called for, and exactly what he's got, is alternative routes for people that want cheaper degrees.
So the employer looks at that and says, well, this kid has the same education as somebody with another degree.
Yeah, but for a lot of these, it's going to, like the one in San Antonio that you can get from Texas A&M San Antonio, you have to get a bachelor's in, you know, like computer technology with an emphasis on like cybersecurity. So, I mean, those employers will look at that degree and it'll be great for them, but I don't know how translatable that is if you want to go into some other profession.
But that's no different, though, for those employers than the kid with the $20,000 degree or the $30,000 degree. Okay.
No. But they didn't get there. They didn't have a traditional college experience to get that. I mean, you know, so you have to decide what your priorities are. But it's all about options. The whole thing, Perry's thing, Dan Branch's thing, Senator Zaffirini in the Senate, their whole thing is sort of about expanding options and making it but it doesn't mean that necessarily things are going to get more affordable. They just might get less affordable more slowly. Well, I guess we didn't get to our two favorite topics, Greg Abbott and the cheerleaders.
Does that mean we're getting to them now, or are we over?
You can say one sentence about them, and then we'll have to leave.
Google Greg Abbott and cheerleaders.
Yeah. Everyone can just read my story about it next week.
It's from Kuntz, which is not too far from where I'm from.
That's right. It's in Hardin County.
Behind the Pine Curtain.
On behalf of Jay, Morgan, Ross, and Todd, and any of you that want to send comments or questions to tribcast@texastribune.org, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening. Do we want lights on for this, or do we want to do this in the dark?